Last week, when we dealt with the issue of monasticism, and I told you how difficult and that I felt that that was, and one of my least favorite lessons to teach, speaking, Phil Remmers is a missionary to China who's here because of knee surgery, and he was with us, and he spent the afternoon with us. He said, David, you might think of one thing. When you're dealing with something like monasticism, you're really dealing, and we mentioned the fact of what is spirituality? What is it to be spiritual? So it's valid, and you could have done a little 5-minute link off the whole thing on monasticism and just discuss what is the issues of spiritual formation. You know, they have departments of spiritual formation in seminaries today. Don Whitney up at Southern Seminary is the one that they look to as being the one to speak of spiritual formation, which is no more than how are you a Christian, and what does that mean? What is the spiritual life in you? What is spirituality? How do you interact with your culture, with your church, etc., like that? That's just spiritual growth. Interesting, I was reading a magazine from Columbia International University, which used to be CBC, came to the gentleman that owned the townhome before mother. So if it comes in the mail, I'm going to read it. And their director of student life, or ever what you call this person, dean of students, talked about they're making a change, and they're calling it spiritual formation. And I read the statement that the faculty had worked out. It was a large statement, but it was a very good statement because it said, what is your source of life, and how does that life work itself out in your relation with your fellow man, your students, your church, etc., like that? So spiritual formation is a valid term. And probably, if the Lord lets me live 2 years, the next time I teach monasticism, I'll try to do 5 minutes of just considering things, because really the consideration of issues like that in the context of church history is what makes the study of church history worth studying, because it does lead to something. I say all that to lead into today's lesson, which I'm calling the wheat and the tares. What we're going to discuss today is how does the church handle sin and sinners? How does the church view sin and sinners? And can they operate together? What should the church do in an attempt to purify itself? So, in dealing with this issue, which is going to be exemplified through two particular men and things that occurred in the church, one of them that occurred for several centuries, we're really coming down to ask the question, what is the nature of the church? That's what it will lead us to do, is ask, what do we view the church as? And a corollary to that, what is the relationship of the church to the civil government? Now, I can assure you, we will only ask the question. We cannot answer it. In this class, men have spent lifetimes trying to answer the correlation of the church to the civil government. But there are questions that need to be considered, particularly in the age in which we live, when there is so much pressure on us as Christians and on us as our identity as a church. Who should be able to call itself a church? Who should get the tax-exempt status, if anybody should get it? What should the civil government do for the church, or the church for the civil government? Big questions. We'll only ask them and speak about them a little bit, but it kind of fits in this lesson this morning. With the conversion of the Emperor Constantine, which we looked at earlier, things changed radically in the church. People reacted differently to the new situation that they found themselves in. The persecuted church was no longer the persecuted church. It became the tolerated church. In fact, before too long, it became the official church of the empire. By 380 AD, Christianity was made the official religion of the Roman Empire, which we'll get to that in 2 weeks. 1 week or 2 weeks. But so going from being persecuted to tolerated to official, wow. How are people going to react to that? Now, you can have different responses when the church became the official religion of the Roman Empire. When it becomes official, don't you think that it's human nature and understandable that wealthy and prominent people would want to be a part of what was now the official thing? So Christianity became a haven, in a sense. The church was a place that officials wanted to be because it was a good thing. The church was the right place to be. So instead of being persecuted, you're now admired for being in it. Well, if that's going to happen, how's your response to that? Eusebius, the historian that we mentioned last week or read about 2 weeks ago because he was talking so much about Constantine, Eusebius thought it was a great thing. He was grateful for the freedom and the prestige that the church received as it became the official religion. But others, understandably, were concerned with this. They were concerned that Christianity was becoming lukewarm. You had a couple of responses. Last week we talked about the response of the people who fled to the desert, the monastics. They could not be a part of this church, so they're going to worship God. It's so important for them to be that way. But there were others in the church, the Donatists are one, which we'll learn about later in this lesson, who simply looked at the larger church and they said, that's not the church. They withdrew, formed their own church, and they said, we're the pure church. Others later, in the end of the 4th century, we will see have a reaction to Christianity, period, through a emperor, I believe his name is Justus I, who attempted for a few years to restore paganism, because he was saying that Christianity caused Rome to have the problems that it was having. And in this era of its life, Rome was having serious problems from the Goths, from the Vandals, from people from the outside coming in against it. And paganism said, no, it's the problem of Christianity. That's why Rome needs to return to its pagan roots. Augustine wrote an answer to this in his City of God that took him like 22 years and 12 volumes to write. But he answered to the fact that no, the problem is not Christianity, not at all Christianity. Anyway, we'll look at the wheat and the tares, the mixture of the church, and the response to what's happening. Back in the 2nd century, we had mentioned Marcion and Montanus. These were men who were considered and were heretics. They founded separate churches. They broke away. They had their own movements, but the movements essentially were crushed. They were crushed because of doctrinal situations and practical situations. They did not exist. In the 3rd and 4th century, two similar movements broke away from the established church, and these movements were much, much more significant. One was called the Novatians. The other one were called the Donatists. The issues that motivated both of these schisms was this: what really is the nature of the true church? The movements were similar. We'll study them together. We'll try to understand the problem that Christians wrestled with and what were the answers that they brought to the problem. As problems arose against the church had to hammer out its doctrine. As heresies arose, as the church answers the heresy, the church clarifies its position as to what it is, what the truth is, etc. As this arose, these schismatic groups arose, the church, the bishops, had to address the issue of what the nature of the church is. This schism, this heresy, causes the church to struggle in such a way that it develops the doctrine of the church that we will see really becomes identified as the Roman Catholic Church. The answer that could be given to when did the Roman Catholic Church begin cannot be pinned exactly to this era, but what began in the church and what became identified as the church and the practice of the church here led within a century and a half to the fact that you could really call it the Roman Catholic Church. Now, I was taught 30 years ago, and Doug was also, that we looked pretty much to Gregory as the first pope of the church, who became pope in 590. But that's only the first pope that was, his rule was universally accepted and his power was over the entire church as it was known then. Probably 100 years earlier, with the ascendancy of a guy named Leo I, which was around 440 AD, which was that mid-5th century, was the first bishop of Rome that had enough power and influence to be considered a pope. So if you want to say, when did the Roman Catholic Church begin instead of just the Catholic Church, certainly by Leo. Now, Brother Lee was raised Roman Catholic, so he was taught that it always was. There was no beginning. It began with Peter, right, brother? That was an assumption. But as we look at it historically, certainly the beginning of the middle of the 5th century, the church that existed could be called the Roman Catholic Church. Here, in answer to this controversy, is the doctrine that lays the foundation for much of that. What was the problem that caused this controversy in the 3rd and 4th century? The problem began with a long debate on how to view post-baptismal sin. I don't know if I made the point clear enough when we spoke about baptism, because I was felt constrained by time, but by the 2nd century, certainly by the 3rd, you can read in the writings of the church that they viewed baptism as having a great cleansing effect. Baptism was a sacrament, and it literally cleansed you from the sin that you had committed up to that point. Could you say this is baptismal regeneration? It was certainly the seeds of that. So from the idea of baptism, in a sense, made your slate completely clean, what are you going to do when you sin after baptism? What about sins committed after baptism? Different people came up with different ideas. We mentioned a book, a writing called The Shepherd of Hermes in the 2nd century. Now, the shepherd, the writer of that, said that God forgives one major sin and one major sin only after baptism. You know?
He gets to
pick
it.
Huh?
He gets to pick it.
Yeah, he gets to pick it. After the one major sin is forgiveness, forgiven, there is no more forgiveness after baptism. Origen, in the middle of the 3rd century, believed that there were three sins that could not be forgiven: idolatry, adultery, and fornication. Seems like two of the three were sexual in nature, so you see they dealt with sexual issues in the 3rd century real bad. Tertullian, in the 3rd century, after Origen, took a little bit more lenient view to begin with, but then he changed his mind. As he became closer to the Montanists, he began to worry that sins were too easily forgiven. In fact, he called the shepherd of Hermes the shepherd of adultery, because he said that one big sin could be forgiven. It seems that so many of the things he dealt with were sexual sins. I have the notes here. Apparently, the sins that worried the church fathers in the early period were sexual sins. How should they deal with people who had fallen into this sin? Well, something arose, though, that was more perplexing than the sexual sin, and that is the sin that we'll call apostasy. What do you do if you've denied the faith? How does the church view you if you've denied the faith? By the middle of the 3rd century, I think we mentioned this last week and we talked before it, the reign of Decius, who came to power as the emperor in 250, for the next 18 months, he exerted a system-wide persecution on the church that was the first system-wide persecution. There had been persecution in areas, geographical areas before, but under Decius, the decree went out that everybody, and what was everybody required to do? They were required to worship the emperor. You had to burn incense, you had to acknowledge the emperor was over everything, or you had to have a paper that said you did. Now, some of us who have been accused of being, I don't want to say devious, but we have ways and means of getting things done. You know, if that was put upon me, I probably could find me a forger or somewhere that would make that paper. You know, so some people in the church got papers that said they had worshiped the emperor when they really hadn't, to keep the persecution off of them. Some did worship the emperor. For 18 months, it was a bad time. Some left. Cyprian, the bishop of Carthage, we're going to mention in a minute, he left town and went out to the desert so he could stay alive. I think he did a good thing. It's good that he stayed alive. I'm not saying, but what do you, when this is over with, you have all these people who have apostatized. What does the church do to receive them back in? Could the Christian church let all these people back in? Was it possible for these fragments which the church had divided into to be regathered? Could the lapsed be restored to the church? And if they could be restored, who could restore them? Well, it seems at this time there arose another class of leaders in the church. Not the bishops, the elders, the presbyters, the deacons, but a class of leaders. Could the Christian church let these people back in? Confessors were a group of people who had been persecuted, but somehow lived. They lived through the persecution. They didn't deny the faith, but the persecution that they were subjected to did not totally kill them. Okay? Well, would you not think that someone who was willing to die for Christ but didn't actually die, they suffered but didn't die, would not you think that they were very special people? I mean, that would just be human nature to think that that person might be a little closer to God because they have suffered. That's almost like the Lord's answered the prayer of this family. I think we want this family to pray for us. I mean, yeah, this person's special, all right? Well, the people who had lapsed, who had apostatized, would go to the confessors, and they would say, I'm sorry. And the confessors generally were pretty lenient with the people. They would say, you know, I understand, pray with them. We think you ought to be back in the church. Well, that was a little bit too easy for some people. This tradition of allowing the fact that the confessors could forgive the sins of the lapsed was not going to do. It wasn't going to happen. It was problematic for two areas. One, it brought a new power in the church. If the confessor could forgive sin, I mean, where's the bishop? Where's the church order? Except it's not going to happen. So you got a problem with that. And if a person could simply go to a confessor and be forgiven and restored, some said that this sounded like cheap forgiveness. It was too easy. One of the men that said it was too easy was named Novatian. Novatian was a Roman presbyter. He became rival to the bishop and got himself elected bishop. He supported a very rigorous position that basically said that the lapsed could not be forgiven. He believed that the church must be a pure church with people who had stood true. The church could not be compromised with people who had failed during the time of the persecution. This dissidence grew. It began in Rome, and it grew throughout the whole empire. And many of the confessors were located in this whole area of North Africa. In the midst of the debate, the dissension came from Cyprian, who was Bishop of Carthage. He was not a Novatianist. He was part of what we would call the Catholic Church. He represented the universal church that they understood the church to be at that time. He gave a lot of thought to the question. Many of the ideas that we'll think about as the nature of the church throughout this course up to the Reformation come from Cyprian. He determined that the church was one church only. He said, outside of the true church, there is no salvation. Baptism outside of the true church was not valid. If you were baptized in a Novatian church, you were not baptized. It had to come from the true church. a person from the Novation Church had to be rebaptized in the Catholic Church if they came. The real authority in the church belonged not to the confessors, but it belonged to the bishops. He honored the confessors. He admired the fact that they had not fled. He was embarrassed by the fact that he actually fled to save his life, though I think that it was providential that he did. 8 years later, Cyprian was martyred himself. He didn't flee the next time a period of persecution came to him. For Cyprian, the authority in the church lay with the bishops and not the confessors. He said that the bishops, though, had to be spiritually qualified men. If you were not a good man, you couldn't be a good bishop. You could not be sinful and a bishop at the same time. This is a very important point because in the controversy with the Donatists later, it comes up over the validity of a bishop if that bishop had sinned. The authority in the church belonged to the bishops. Therefore, if you had a lapsed bishop, one who had defied the faith, how could he be restored? Cyprian was not sure, hardly, that a lapsed, absolutely lapsed bishop could be restored to positions, but he did believe that church members who were repentant could be properly disciplined and restored with care to the church. Cyprian did not make it too easy. He, in fact, called for a serious period of time. Later, it's even talked about the fact that a person who was wanting to be restored would begin by standing outside of the church, asking for the prayers of the people as they went in. Then that person would go inside the church, and then eventually that person would join the congregation in praying, and then they would be restored to fellowship, and restoring to fellowship means being welcomed to the Lord's table. The ultimate sign of fellowship of the church was the weekly observance of the Eucharist of the Lord's table. And the exclusion from the Eucharist was a serious, serious matter because it said you are not in fellowship with the church. That's why there's so much variables in the matter of who should be allowed at the Lord's table. We will see historic Baptist positions. We will see Reformed positions. We practice a muddled position, which I'm fairly comfortable with, to tell you the truth. I'm not as Baptist as some of my Baptist brethren who want only baptized by immersion people to come to the table. There are some Baptists that hold that position. We have always held here that a person should be an active member of a biblical church to come to the table. Right now we say if you are professed in union with Christ, you're welcome at the table. That's not a bad position in my personal feeling to take. But the matter of the Eucharist is serious in the life of the church. Very, very serious. Because tell you what, there is very little reason, in fact there may be no reason, for a Christian not to be joined to a local church. That we will also find out through history, even when the church is not what it should be. Certainly by the time of the Reformation, there's no reason for a church, a person not to be. And today, you need to find a church to be part of. It's good for your soul, and I think it's proper. Anyway, how do you take these people back into the church? He tried to make his way between what he saw was two extremes. The too strict extreme that would never let them back in. The too lax that let them back in too quickly. Discipline always causes tension. Well, all of this died down. The persecution, Decius, was over with. For about 260 to 300, the church lived in relative peace, but the problem came up again, came up with the persecution under Diocletian. This persecution began in the army in 295, but it began throughout the Roman Empire in 303. And one difference in this persecution, it didn't tell you just to acknowledge the emperor was a god. It said for you to give over your holy scriptures. We mentioned this last week. The fact that under the Diocletian persecution, the church and the church leaders were called to give up the scriptures. That is serious. People were required to give up portions of the scripture that they had in their homes. When they gave them up, they were burned. Many people did this. And the people who did this were called traitors or traditors, those who handed things over. I think it's a cute point that some of the things handed over were not really the scriptures. They probably gave them the Gospel of Judas or something like that. But you know, the Roman authorities were not exactly authorities in canon law. So some Christians passed off writings that really were not the writings of the prophets and the apostles and got out of it that way. Unfortunately, others did not. They gave over the real scriptures. We come back then to the question. After the persecution was over, the people were sorry for what they had done. Could they be allowed back into the church? The leader of a strict group this time was a man by the name of Donatus. Now, I didn't put his name up, but I put the area that we're dealing with here. Donatus was a rival bishop in Carthage. The bishop of Carthage was a man by the name of Caecilian, C-A-E-C-L-I-A-N. Caecilian had been elected bishop of the church. He'd been ordained by three other bishops to be bishop of the church. But there was a man by the name of Margerinus who disagreed with this. He said that Caecilian had actually been ordained by one man who himself was a traitor. Margerinus dies, and a guy named Donatus, Donatus of Caesarea Negra, takes his place. Donatus was a fiery individual. He opposed the bishop, Caecilian. He said that Caecilian had been ordained invalidly, and that the church could not be a church led by this man. You had the rival claims of what the legitimate church was. The Donatus said, "We are a church of the martyrs. We are a pure and holy church," over against the Catholics. He said the Catholics were not a pure church. They were a church that was of mixed personage. Anytime you have questions like this, anytime you look at church history and see religious wars that break out, we'll find that religious wars are never purely religious wars. There are always other issues that complicate the situation. And that was the thing here. You had theological issues, you had economic issues, you had social issues. Carthage is here. This area was called Proconsular Africa. Anyway, the areas of Numidia and Mauritania were agricultural areas. I don't think of Africa in wheat, okay? I think of Africa because I think the desert is so big, you think of the Sahara. But this area of North Africa is very fertile, I've been told, and it was the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. I've seen between 60 and 80% of the wheat and the produce that Rome got came from this area of North Africa. Now, think about this. Carthage is inhabited by many Italians who've come over from Rome. This is where the trading is done. These are the farms. Now, the farmer works hard hours, long days, many weeks and months for his crop, and generally feels like he doesn't get what the crop is worth. He gets a shekel a pound, let's say that. But the trader in Carthage who has the shekel to buy it sends it to Rome and he gets three shekels a pound, so he makes money. More money than the farmer who's worked harder. You have a class warfare that's coming here for economic reasons. The native peoples of this area were called Punic people. They were Berbers. They had fought against Rome and lost. And so the people in the areas of Mauritania and Numidia, they didn't speak the Roman language, Latin. They were not Romanized. The people in Carthage were Romanized. So you have class distinctions coming here. Every time there is a religious war, every time there's religious controversy and politics is involved, like in Northern Ireland today, there are issues far beyond religion that fueled these things, and that there were issues beyond religion that were fueling these things. The church appealed to the new emperor Constantine in 314. Constantine says, "Nope, Caecilian, he's the real bishop. Donatus, you're not." 321, there was a council. They were ruled against, and the Donatists were said, "You are not a part of the church." But the Donatists continued to grow. The Donatists, by the middle of that century, Circumcilians, fanatical followers of Donatism, and the word Circumcilian comes from the Latin words, I think, circus cellus, to surround in a circle. They literally were hordes of fanatical warriors, and they would encircle a Catholic village, and they would attack the village. But because the Lord told you not to take up a sword, they used clubs, big clubs. So they were legalistic in following the Lord's command not to take up the sword, but they used clubs, and they used them violently to overrun the villages. Sometimes if there was a monastery there, they would... The nuns don't live in monastery. What nuns lived in convents. If there was a convent there, they would do unnice things to the ladies in the convent. So, but these, you know, they were trying to follow Christ. They had a martyr's complex. You couldn't be a martyr anymore because they wasn't killing you for being a Christian. So the next best things, if I die purifying the church, then I'm just as good as a martyr, part of their thinking. Anyway, this is a real, real problem. The Donatist church exists for the next 100 and some years. Hard for us to think in these terms. You know, we've been around 30 years, and the Reformed Baptist movement actually has been around maybe 50 years, and, you know, the Baptist church as an identifiable entity has been around maybe 400 years. And, you know, we're looking at long periods of time here. We're going to skip ahead to the next century, because that's when the Donatus issue was really handled. Y'all see the little town Hippo there, and I think that probably makes everyone think of Augustine. And that's what we're going to talk about next. Augustine was faced with the Donatist problem. In fact, by the time he became pastor or bishop of Hippo, in the very block where his church was located was a larger church that was a Donatist church with a bishop in it. Augustine said that he could actually hear them singing up there. He called their singing, if you would call it singing, he said it was more like the roaring of lions. He might have been a tad biased against this rival church. It's not strange for us to think of two churches being in the same block, but it was very strange then. There was one church. There wasn't two. The church was split in two. How was this issue to be solved? Could it be solved? Augustine played the central part in solving it, if we want to say what they came up with was really the actual answer. Doug will teach two good lessons on Augustine the 1st of January, because, and I'm not stealing any of his thunder to do this, but and he'll probably tell us this again, but that's okay. We have to hear twice to remember sometimes. Augustine insisted that the visible church is not a perfect church, but it is a pilgrim church, italicized mine. The Donatists had taken a stand on a pure church with saints and not sinners. Augustine disagreed. The church is a pilgrim church, not a perfect church. In his anti-Donatist writings, Augustine pointed out that even the Donatist churches were filled with sinners. Despite their claims of being a pure church, there were people in those churches that were drunkards, adulterers, some probably guilty of apostasy also. But that's not the major point, he said. He's not saying our church is better than yours, or you are just as bad as we are. He does point out that there are sinners left both in the Catholic and the Donatist church. Augustine said the church is like Noah's Ark. There were clean and unclean animals on the ark. The Donatist says, well, we think the church is like Noah's Ark. Noah's Ark was pitched on the inside to keep the water out. And he says, we pitched the church on its walls to keep the sinners out. So you say they both used Noah's Ark, and neither one of them used it quite the right way. Augustine was arguing that there was the holiness of the church, though, was not based on the lifestyle of its members, but on the purity of Christ. That's why he says that we are one holy apostolic church, not because we're so good, but because of Christ's holiness. This is his church, and therefore it is holy, because it is his church. Of course, it's right for us to try to be holy, Augustine said, but there's always going to be sin. He was afraid that the Donatist insistence on a pure church would lead to legalism. And that was a battle he was fighting with Pelagius at that very time. And he was right. It does lead to legalism. The Donatists had a tendency to revert to the law to say, quote, if we are good and righteous and holy, then we find favor in God's sight. We hear that today in performance-based sanctification and a lot of other things. There was too much of that for Augustine. He said, the church is holy because Christ is holy. We are a pilgrim church walking through this world, but we are not by any means a perfect or a pure church in the sense of our own holiness. He recognized that the church consisted of sinners and saints. He was not against church discipline, but he was very much for church unity. He says we must never neglect severe discipline in the maintenance of unity, but we must not be intemperate, must not by intemperate correction break the bond of fellowship. He recognized the tension that existed between the two. It's interesting that Augustine liked to quote this quote from Cyprian, "Let a man mercifully correct what he can. Let him patiently bear what he cannot correct. And let him groan in sorrow over it with love." Now, we would probably read that and think it was a little compromising there. Well, John Calvin used this same quote in the Institutes. He did not think it was compromising to realize that there were things that could not be corrected. Of course, Calvin also had a view of the church that you entered it by baptism as an infant, and you were part of a large church that encompassed everyone in the town. That's not the view that we have of the church. As time went on, the Catholics, including Augustine, felt that something had to be done. Donatism had spread. In fact, there were more Donatist Christians in North Africa than there were Catholic Christians. In 411, a church council was convened. A church council was really a state church council because the state was convening this. Augustine agreed with others that it would be right to use force if necessary to cause the Donatists to forsake their ways. Using the phrase that Jesus says, "compel them to come in," was the cry of the ones who would use the sword to compel attendance to the church. They thought that they could compel the obstinate to come in to the church. We know that was not the case. We know that, in fact, this begins a long, sordid history of the church relying on the state and using the arm of the sword to try to enforce its ways. Augustine gave his justification. He says, "You too are Christ's sheep. You bear the Lord and the Lord's Supper you have received, but you have strayed and gotten lost. There is no reason for you to be angry with me because I'm bringing back the strays and seeking the lost. It is better for me to do the Lord's will. It is he who counsels me to compel you to return to the fold than to give my consent to the will of the straying sheep and allow you to be lost. Do not say then what I always hear you saying, 'I want to stay, I want to be lost.' It is better for me not to allow that at all so far as it is possible." He felt that he was doing the Lord's will in entering into this compulsion to bring the people back in. Well, Donatism was broken by this action. It lasted another 100 years, but it was broken. Some would say that because of this action and because of the existence of the Donatist, that it made North Africa so ripe to be overrun by Muslims in the 7th century. And that may be the case because with the spread of Islam, we'll see in January when we deal with it, there was virtually no opposition in North Africa. It just spread right through the whole thing. But you have to come to think of what Augustine thought about on what made the church valid, the sacraments valid. Ex opera operata. Augustine was saying that the sacraments are valid because of the work of Christ, not because of the minister who performed them. Otherwise, if you got the sacraments from a priest who was a sinner, the sacraments were still good because they were based on Christ's work. This becomes a arguing point throughout the history of the church. Cyprian said, "You cannot have God for your father unless you have the church for your mother." Augustine quoted that. John Calvin quoted it. But you'd have to ask with Calvin, what church was he talking about? What is the one pure church? The church is a holy church. This has to do with God's gifts to the church, not with the inherent sanctity of members or ministers. Most of Christendom has come to embrace this. Certainly by the Protestant Reformation, we would say that the church is not based on age or size. It's based on the presence of marks, which we say are the preaching of the word and the proper administration of the sacraments. That's the nature of the church. But how can the church be so split? For the next 1,000 years, they're going to say that the Catholic Church is one church, but we know in the middle of the 11th century, the church split from the west to the east. The 16th century, the Protestant church pulled out of the Catholic church. And as soon as the Protestant church was formed, it started splitting like crazy. I mean, you know, we split exponentially because the Protestants just continued to split on, if you don't like what this one's doing, do another. But what is that valid? What is it valid for the church to do in the matter of this? And is it valid for the state to enter in to the church's business? I began thinking this week on that, and I didn't put this quote up here. I'm sorry I didn't. I ran out of time to get the quote up there. On the whole matter of the state and the church and the matter of religious liberty, what do you think religious liberty is? I want us to just talk for a few minutes about this as we conclude this morning, because it deals with what the church is too. But what is religious liberty? Who would venture a guess, an answer? You can't answer wrong. There's no such thing as a wrong answer. So, share, what is religious liberty?
David, are you asking within the context of as a Christian, or are you asking inclusive of Islam and Judaism and so forth?
I'm asking it as a tenet of, let's say, of the Constitution, that in America we're guaranteed religious liberty. What is religious liberty?
That's supposed to be Christian worship of God.
Really? A Christian worship of God? Dana?
I think it means that you have the freedom to follow the dictates of your own conscience, whatever you're compelled within the laws of the land to follow your convictions and practices and.
So we got one voting for a Christian worship. We got one voting for the dictates of your conscience. Go ahead, Paul.
Freedom from compulsion or coercion from in matters, in religious matters.
Freedom from coercion.
Coercion or
compulsion.
Ken? I was going to add that to what Dan said.
I think a simple statement is religious liberty is the conviction that the temporal sword ought not to be employed in strictly spiritual matters, which I'm agreeing with this side of the room. Sorry, Phil. Because Christian has nothing to do with religious liberty. I want everybody to worship. I want everybody to be confessional. I want them to be reformed. I want them to lead separate lives, as I understand what that is. Maybe not as that, but you see, but the Islamist has as much right to have his mosque in this next block. Now, what the Islamist does not have the right to do is to teach a doctrine that calls for the overthrow of the government and the breaking of temporal law. That nobody, B-O-D-Y, of people have the right to propagate a doctrine or a teaching that violates, certainly doesn't violate the last six commandments. You cannot violate life. You cannot have that doctrine And there, you don't have the right to that, but you have the right to worship. And it's a hard thing to allow someone to be wrong. But you know what? I think we have to, because the state may be viewing us as wrong. And, you know, we want to have the right. I believe in strict government within the walls of the church, but not that the government has to do with the church. We govern ourselves. We exercise capital punishment. What's capital punishment within the church? It is excommunication. In a sense, think of it like that. What's the if you value affiliation and association with the church? Now, a lot of people don't value that association today. Today, people are doing a smorgasbord. They pick up a little bit here. They pick up a little bit there. And, you know, I want to listen to Piper. Don't get me wrong. But I'm not a member of Bethlehem Baptist Church. I'm a member of Grace Reform. I am a member somewhere, and I'm accountable to the government authorities of this church. That happens to be elders. But, I mean, I am accountable to that. And if I do wrong, and if I don't repent, they can exercise capital punishment on me by excommunicating me. And to some people, that's no big thing, because they wasn't concerned about being a member anyway. But we need to value church membership, which I think we do. But we also need to say that we operate our own affairs and the state does not enter into our affairs. And that allows somebody to operate really crazy with crazy doctrine. But it's their right to do it if they're not breaking the laws of the state and murdering someone. Steve?
In light of what's happened out west recently, what is our position on the... I mean, you were fairly strict in your statement there, like the polygamous, okay?
Right.
And how do you deal with that in a country like Saudi Arabia where polygamy is fine?
In a country like Saudi Arabia, they don't practice religious liberty. So, I mean, it's a question that's a non-question when you put it in the context of that country. A country that practices religious liberty, though, the religious liberty still operates under a government-recognized moral law code, okay? The government can say that a marriage could be between a man and a woman, which the government should say that. So the government has a right to enforce its laws. Now, I reckon the question is going to come up that what if the government says to the church that the church cannot exercise its freedom of speech if preaching of the moral law means that you're pointing out that homosexuals are violating the moral law of God, and that's hate speech as it is in Canada today. What is the church to do in that situation? The church is to be faithful to its creator and its Lord in that situation right there. But the state should not be regulating that. The state should be regulating taxes. It should be regulating military. It should be operating for our protection. It should create a society in which we can live as free people and not murder one another, but it shouldn't enter into that.
I wish you hadn't said that last statement, because that's going to make me be the devil's advocate.
Go ahead, brother.
Marriage is an institution common to all men.
Right.
It's not a religious institution. It's part of the Christian mandate, just like work is, and binding upon non-Christian as well as Christian. As such, it is part of society, and it falls, I believe, under the government's domain of social order. And I don't think it is at all a church issue. That's my personal opinion. I know that it's been brought into the church over the last few hundred years as we've made it more and more into something of a sacrament. Mm. But historically, marriage has always, even up through the Reformation and Puritan era, has always been viewed as a matter of the state, not of the church. So if the federal government decided to say polygamy is okay, we as Christians have the obligation to preach what the Scripture says. We can oppose that, but it's the government's right to make those rules.
I think I agree. I agree that in reading apologists of current issues on matters of marriage, it's very interesting. And the problem when you get a mind as mushy as mine. You read a lot, and you just don't remember where you read it. But just this week, I was reading a wonderful argument on the sanctity of marriage, and then it came from a non-Christian. I mean, this guy, I mean, he virtually was an atheist, but he was saying that it's society's right. And when you leave that, when you leave that and you allow for the easy divorce and whatever like that, the rest of it will have to follow. I mean, you've lost that. I do wish that was a great blog.
Well, I just can say that. I say that because to defend marriage politically, we're doing so as American citizens exercising a political voice.
Mm.
When we ask for a marriage amendment or something of that nature, if it were a church issue, then we would have no right to ask for that.
Mm.
The position of our religion and others, we would have no right. We do have a right to ask for that because as American citizens, it is a political issue, and we're speaking as American citizens.
I'm gonna give you two quotes and leave. I made about the matter of the church exercising its discipline. Can you imagine Oliver Cromwell said in an address in 1652 that he had rather have Mohammedans, might as well say Muslims, he had rather that Muslims were permitted amongst us than that one of God's children should be persecuted. He saw no grounds for the persecution of anyone that claimed to be God's child in the name of religion. He had just come through that period of persecution where the episcopacy was aligned. He didn't want the episcopacy. He didn't want Scottish Presbyterianism because he did not want an enforced church on anyone. He wanted religious liberty. John Owen, who was his chaplain, says this, "The Spirit..." I wish I could have put this up. "The Spirit of Christ is in himself too free, great, and generous a spirit to suffer himself to be used by any human arm to whip men into belief. He drives not, but gently leads into all truth and persuades men to dwell in the tents of like precious faith, which would lose of its preciousness and value if that sparkle of freeness shone not in it." We have a free association of people who come together to worship our King. We agree in a doctrinal confessional statement, but nobody makes us be a member of this church. The government cannot make us a member, nor can the government forbid us to be a member. Anyway, it's a religious liberty is a Baptist commitment that, as one person says, it reminds the government not to presume to take up authority that belongs to God alone. It reminds the church not to trust in chariot or horses. With that, we will leave. Thank you.